Right. Thank you very much for inviting me. So yeah, I'm talking about Chandler's cosine problem. In actual fact, I'm talking about, I suppose, a slightly different version of the question, but it's motivated by an original problem due to Chandler, which I think it is worth starting with. So just to remind you, if A is a finite subset of integers, then I'll write 1A hat as beta for the exponential sum associated with A, evaluated at theta, where theta is on the circle group. So, if A is also a symmetric set, then this quantity is real. And so you can ask what the extreme real values it takes are. So in the positive instance, I suppose you always have that the exponential sum or the Fourier transform at naught is mod A, and it clearly can't be bigger than this. So sort of for positive values, it's not a sort of interesting question. But you can ask also how large a negative value, 1A theta, can take. And indeed, Chandler asked this question, and he asked for a bound uniform in the size of A. Okay? So I'm going to write mz of A for this quantity, so it's sort of the suff minus 1A hat. Theta in T. Okay, the most negative value. Now, the advantage of introducing Chandler's original problem here actually is that it's associated with quite a few good names. I haven't read in detail Chandler's original work. The review of it relates it to Selberg. Now, I've not ever been able to relate anything to Selberg before, so apparently he uses a method of Selberg to address this question. It was in about the 60s, so it didn't go so well in terms of bounds. The most obvious approach is to relate it to the algebra norm, which I'll just define now. The L1 norm of the Fourier transform, so it's just integral 1A hat theta d theta. That's where this is, whatever the vague or half measure. And so you see, well, by the inversion, by the Fourier inversion formula, you have that 1A of x is equal to the integral 1a half of theta, e of x theta, d theta. So I should have put some complex conjugates up there. And so in particular, at naught, you have that 1, because 1a hat, 1a of naught can't be more than 1, at least this integral. And this, in turn, is of course at least the algebra norm minus twice this this minimum that we're interested in, this mz of A. And so you have the mz of A is I made the algebra norm. And initially the natural approach to bounding this guy from below was to try and provide bounds for this guy. Again, uniform in the size of A. And the problem of bounding this guy was called Littlewood's problem or Littlewood's conjecture or something like that. I think it's instructive, though, if we just if we look at a couple of examples, because it will sort of become clear that this is actually a very bad approach if we do that. So the two most obvious types of set A that you might look at are the very structured case, so that's an interval, or in the transform space, that's a Dirichlet kernel. So if A is minus NN or something. Then 1A hat of theta looks like this. It's periodic, right? So it does this again with this peak at the origin here of the size of A. And this guy down here is some constant fraction of the size of A, okay? So in this instance, NZ of A is, you know, at least constant A. Okay, so that's pretty enormous. The other type of structure that you would try and look at in this situation, of course, is the random case. So that's because Z is discrete, that means you want A to be lacunary. Say as lacunary as you like. I'm not too concerned about that. So in that instance, because you can identify sort of Z with the dual of the circle, A behaves like a sum of mod A independent random variables. Okay? And so in particular, it certainly takes a negative value. And you can arrange it so this is about as good as you can get. In particular, of size, maybe up to some logs, you know, and constants and this sort of nonsense. Root mod A. And so the objective is to show, I suppose, what Chawla would have liked, I guess, was to show that MZ of A is at least, well, at the very least, some power of A, and maybe a power like a half minus epsilon. Okay? Now, if you go back to this bound here, you can sort of explore what this quantity is in these two cases. So, this guy, of course, behaves like 1 over R, or, well, 1 over, yeah, 1 over R. And so, here you have, unfortunately, it's about log mod A. Here, again, because it behaves like a random variable, this actually does behave like root mod A up to some logs again. So that's a little bit unfortunate. Although, in the lacunary case, this sort of somehow comes out at more or less the right bound. in the highly structured case, the case of the interval or dilator, translated interval, it's a complete disaster because this is supposed to be almost as big as A, and the lower bound is log. Nevertheless, I mean, you want something. So people approach the problem sort of through this method. Is omega of the size of A? Oh, I see that. No. Well, sort of qualitatively, I suppose it's clear. But no, it's no. You want to show yes, exactly, kind of any sort of bound. So yeah, that's fair. Well, okay. Sort of the qualitatively clear for the dual problem. So the dual problem. So if you replace, if you take A to be a measure, a half set in T, then it's clear because you still have this sort of result, but this guy tends to infinity because if the algebra norm is finite, then one sub A has to be continuous and has to behave, in fact, robustly continuously, and it doesn't behave robustly continuously because it's a step function. But no, you have to show that it tends to infinity. Right, so people like it sort of to continue my sort of name dropping, I suppose. Roth tried this problem and got omega of root log. And actually then, that was the best for a little while before. So I should say, when I said this was Littlewood's question, he asked for these bounds. He moreover conjectured that this, if you like, is the worst case. So he conjectured that 1 sub A, the algebra norm of 1 sub A, is always at least log mod A. And Littlewood's conjecture was proved. By Koniargin, and sort of separately by McGee and Smith in 1980s or something like that, 1980s, sorry. And so that gave then immediately that this is at least log mod A. And it sort of became then somehow, then you have, if you like, the real question, because the real question is somehow you want a deep log. But to do that, you're going to have to do something slightly more than just use this inequality, because the lower bound on this can't be better than what was stated. So Bourgain managed to do that. In something like 86. And I want to sort of stress that log barrier because it'll sort of come up later. It's sort of quite important. Showed, I mean, still a hopelessly poor bound, but much better than the log. And then Ruja, a very nice refinement of Bourgain's approach, showed of root log. So he got this factor omega of 1 up to half, basically. Okay, and that's the best known for this particular problem here. Now, so recently, Green and Korniagin considered a mod p analog of Littlewood's conjecture. Okay. So you can define the Fourier transform, and again, so in this world we're thinking of Z mod pz as being discrete. So I'm measuring by counting. So my Fourier transform is defined like that, and then on Fourier space the normalization is weighted. Each point has mass 1 over p. But you have a slight problem. You want to bound. We have A and ZP. I should say, of course, P prime. And you want a lower bound on this. There's a real problem with this, because actually this can be very small. If A is the whole group, this can be very small even when A is large. If A is the whole group, of course, I drew this lovely kernel for you up here, but it only hammers this point, and then this point, and then this point, and then this point, and this point, by design, of course. So this is 1. And that... obviously doesn't turn to infinity. But in that instance, A is behaving like a subgroup, and subgroups, of course, all have this property. The transform of a subgroup is a suitably normalized subgroup in Fourier space, and that's always going to have a small algebra norm in this way. But if you arrange things so to avoid subgroups, and a particular way of doing it is if you insist, say, that A has about half of the elements in P, then they showed that you can get a power of log p. Okay? And the same averaging argument applies then to tell you that in the mod p analog of Chawla's problem, you have you can get this power here. So this inequality remains true. It's just a trivial averaging statement. And you can ask, but you can ask more generally. For a Chawla's problem in, say, Z modulo PZ. Even more than that, and I would like to state it in just a smidgen more generality, in any finite abelian group. So, and in that setting, we can actually make sort of considerable progress over this log bound. So that the theorem I really want to talk to you about today is, suppose A is in G, a finite abelian group, we'll have this sort of slightly irritating density hypothesis. I'll come back to in a moment, and we need the thing to be symmetric. Again, to ensure that the question makes sense, the transform is real. Then, mg of A, and this is defined in a completely obvious sense, right? I mean, so I wrote Z before, and this is just now for the group G, is p to the omega of 1. Okay, so we really get a genuine power of P. This power depends in a feeble way, well, in a bad way, I mean, on this the density of the set A. A is essentially, not another parameter. So that would have been true if we taken A to be their set of size P plus 1 over 2. Or A is very close to a subgroup. So subgroups are not only problematic for the Littlewood problem where they have a small algebra norm, but they're problematic if you want a negative Fourier coefficient. Again, transform of the subgroup is a positively scaled subgroup. And so it's all the Fourier coefficients are non-negative. So you can't hope to avoid this second possibility. So you have exactly two cases. You have either this is sort of large, or A is really very close to a subgroup. So in the case of ZP, once you take K to be, you know, P over 4 or something, then this case cannot happen if A has size sort of P plus 1 over 2. And so you're left with it being a power of P. Okay? I also want to sort of perhaps it's slightly related to the original Chandler question, since we took a sup over T for n sub z of A, and here we're taking a sup over so it's not every point, but it's sort of there and there and there and there and there. So it's a sort of smaller set we're taking a sup over, so it's harder to show that it's large. And moreover, it's not always large because you introduce these, because there's this possibility of the structure actually being a subgroup. Okay? Right. Now, there is even a slightly more general version of this that maybe I'll get to at the very end, without this density hypothesis, but you really pay for this in an excruciating fashion as regards this bound here. Okay. Right. So the proof. The proof, in some sense, is there's a neat idea that I think people, certainly I would love to be able to use in a more general setting that we will be able to use in the proof. And so it's more, I suppose, it's not an idea I think due to me, it's an idea lots of people have used. In particular, Bourgain uses a similar idea in his approach. That you'd like to be able to use in other settings, but I'll try and explain also why you somehow can't. But so let's start just with a trivial observation. Right, trivial. To show that it has to be kind of negative at all. If it's not a subgroup. Okay? So we'll consider the situation where A and G as asymmetric, non-empty. Non-empty. Then, well, we have two cases again. So either mg of A is omega of 1, so it's crucially not 0, or A is a subgroup of G. Okay? So this is completely standard type of result. And you do it by examining test functions. Okay, so you pick an appropriate test function to inner product anyway. So in particular here, I guess we take if A is not a subgroup of G, then by symmetry, there are X and Y in A such that X plus Y is not in A. Okay? And so you consider the inner product, deltas denote delta functions, and perhaps this looks a little bit more complicated than it, well, it certainly looks more complicated than it is, but let me just sort of say now in words what we're doing. All we're doing is on physical space, I'm kind of picking out x and minus x, which are both in A, north the identity. Say I make this hypothesis, and it doesn't really matter, but say, for argument's sake, I put north in A. So this convolution, okay, delta naught convolved with delta naught is just delta naught. Delta naught with delta x is just delta x. And so you just, the convolutions of delta functions just reflect the underlying group operation. And so you just have to count which things are in A and which things aren't. Okay? So for an upper bound, say, well, one is, 0 is in A, so you get 1 from this term. X and Y are both in A, and we have symmetry. And I put these minuses in quickly a moment ago because they really need to be minuses. So you get a minus 2 from, well, first of all, that convolved with that inner product that, and that convolved with that inner product that. And then we get this sort of junk term at the end. Now, if we didn't know anything about X and Y being in A, then that could be as large as 1, and we could end up with sort of having no information here. But in fact, that's at most a quarter by symmetry, so you get that this is at most minus a half. So this inner product is negative. On the other hand, when you Fourier transform these deltas, you get cosines. Well, delta naught just goes to 1, right? Spikes go flat when you transform them. And these delta x plus delta minus x has just become cosines. So this becomes 1 minus cos, I suppose, somehow fractional part of gamma of x, or something like that, times 1 minus cos. Fractional part of gamma of y in a product 1a hat. Okay? So this here, for some reason I've written it like that, so that is what that transforms to. And in particular, say this is, you know, at least, I don't know, 4 times the, I'll say, minus 4 times mg of a. Worst case scenario, you think this being all negative, this guy's positive. So you get whatever it is. But I write it up here. So you get that you're in case one. Okay? Now, and this, although this doesn't really drive the proof, somehow this motivates you to try and construct an argument of the form, suppose I can find a subspace on which A on average behaves well, meaning on which 1 sub A convolved with, 1 sub A averaged over cosets of that subspace looks quite a lot like 1 sub A, then I can use an argument like this to actually show that the mass concentrates on the original subspace, meaning the coset of the subspace at the origin, the subspace itself. Because this argument, I mean, as you can see, it's so simple as it has to be sort of incredibly robust under pratting around with A. And so if you make sort of A kind of almost Boolean function, either in an L-infinity or an L-1 sense, you can still draw a conclusion of this shape. Okay? So we're drawn to, if you like, trying to find a subspace. That's right here. Drawn to finding, I say subspace, I mean subgroup. A subgroup V of G such that, say for argument's sake, the one norm is small. Well, actually, no, two norm would be easier to measure that. So mu sub V here is just the probability measure on V. So just averaging over cosets of V. Okay? Now this is quite, it's quite encouraging because, well, maybe I haven't. That, this lets you assume that, effectively it lets you assume that the algebra norm of your function is quite small. Okay, otherwise this would be sort of big for free. So quite small here, of course, is not log. I mean, quite small is going to end up being a sort of a power of this parameter k. But that's much smaller, if you like, than it could be. This guy, generically, this guy is as large as root mod g, and you have no way of and you have no way of sort of saying any more than that. And as soon as you have, of course, bounds on this guy, you know that 1 sub a is behaving in an incredibly smooth sort of way. In fact, there are a lot of arguments where people sort of observe that you can get better results than is true for generic sets by assuming some extra smoothness hypothesis like this, which is, of course, kind of trivially true. And that already, I think, reflects a limitation of being able to transfer any kind of element of this sphere of ideas elsewhere. Because it's really quite rare that you have this sort of smoothness information. So what I mean in one sentence is a generic set A does not have small algebra norm. It has very, very large algebra norm. And so there's no useful algebra norm hypothesis that you can put that you can assume that it has. Okay? Right. Now, when the algebra norm is small, you can conclude quite easily that you have a large Fourier coefficient. Unfortunately, not a large negative Fourier coefficient, just the Fourier coefficient is large in absolute value. And that's just the triangle inequality. Holders or something, a sort of standard inequality. So we have by Parseval's theorem, I'll say by definition, and then by Parseval's theorem, I'm going to subtract the trivial mode because that's always large. This is equal to sort of the integral over gamma not equal to zero. Finding out of gamma squared d gamma. And this is at most the algebra norm times this. Okay? So if this guy were, so you see, if the algebra norm is very small, then we're kind of in good shape. We have a large. So if the algebra norm is very small, and if this were negative, of course we'd be in great shape, right? We'd have our large negative Fourier coefficient. So the problem, if you like, is if it's positive, and you try and group together, sort of, all these positive Fourier coefficients, define the subspace they generate, and hope that this subspace has some sort of approximation property like this, which it will do. Okay? So the key driver that you need if you're doing something like that is to somehow be able to take a large positive Fourier coefficient and make it tell you something about a large negative Fourier coefficient. Okay, and this is where I use this slightly peculiar fact. So you have that 1a squared is equal to 1a. This just takes the values 0 and 1. Okay? And so you can Fourier transform this expression like this. Now, as it stands, this is a hopelessly stupid idea. Because, again, generically, you don't know anything about this guy. You know that it's an L2 and the convolution of two L2 functions. Well, that's... okay, that's in C or L infinity. Well, I mean, since all our groups are, in fact... finite, you may as well just say L infinity. And moreover, the L infinity bound that you get by basically by applying Cauchy-Schwarz can tell you nothing more than the trivial instance of the Hausdorff-Young inequality. So you really gain sort of absolutely nothing in the generic case. And so although it's very appealing to try and use this in all sorts of other problems, it's game over unless you have more information. Okay? Of course, we do. We're allowed to assume that the algebra norm, which is the L1 norm of this guy, is small. And so then this has a much sort of greater kind of smoothing effect and tells you much more somehow about how this guy behaves. Okay? And so in particular, we're going to use it, actually, we're going to use a higher, sort of a higher iteration of this. But let's write, for convenience, sort of F for the function that just takes the only takes the positive values of these guys, right? So, well, f is very close. In L infinity, right? Because we're kind of assuming this guy's small otherwise, again. Again, that doesn't match. And then if you couple this with our smoothness sort of estimate, then you can get sort of, you also get that this is true, and, well, further, that the R-fold convolution, I've settled on denoting this superscript bracket R, approximately f for any r bigger than 0. And now we examine. Sorry. Using basically just the inclusion exclusion principle, to be honest. We examine f minus. The indicator function of this claimed sort of large Fourier coefficient. So suppose we're given gamma such that 1a hat of gamma equals epsilon mod a. And we're taking, I mean, this epsilon is some small proportion. So that's what's coming out of this up here. And we're assuming it's positive, otherwise we're done. Okay? And we, if you look at this function here, okay, this guy's positive, right? Just by how we've arranged it. So you can convolve a load of times, and the thing's still positive. And then you can expand this out. I'm not going to just. I mean, it's effectively, I suppose, using inclusion exclusion. And you get sort of this. FR is the first term, minus epsilon mod A, R epsilon mod A, FR minus 1. Sorry. And you want to, it's everywhere greater than 0, and in particular at gamma it's greater than 0. So this gets you FR of gamma. And this gets you FR minus 1 of gamma, because you convolve, and you get FR minus 1 convolved with 1 sub gamma, and mod G. That gamma cancels with that gamma. Okay, that's quite important. This here. Plus some other terms which will, they contribute basically an error which, this is not really, it's not quite true, but they contribute basically an error of this shape. Okay, this is greater than or equal to naught. And then when we approximate, we then use the directive, this fact up here, to approximate, well, here, this by just f of gamma, so you end up with, well, 1a hat of gamma, which is just epsilon mod a, minus r epsilon mod a times mod a over mod g, plus, now the errors in this approximation are essentially of this form, mg of a times this smoothness factor to something like the r, plus, and then you get this error term here. This is greater than or equal to naught. Okay? So of course you can see what we're going to do here. We're just going to take r to be essentially 1 over, we'll say 2 over the density of a. That will make this term dominate this term. This has an epsilon in it, this has an epsilon squared, so provided the Fourier coefficient we found wasn't too big, the large negative here will dominate this term here, and we'll just end up with this error term has to kill off this whole large negative. And in particular, that tells you that this guy has to be big. Okay? So, you can use this to say that then, well, either, yeah, so this tells you effectively that you can use this large positive Fourier coefficient to spit out this large negative Fourier coefficient, unless the Fourier coefficient that you found here was too large to start with. And all you then do is you collect together those that are, so to speak, too large. You then observe there can't be any in the sort of a long next range, so you have a large spectral gap, effectively, or a large sort of projected spectral gap, which lets your range for this to be small. And so you have this situation with V, a relatively large subspace, and then you can input that into some suitable variant of this lemma, approximated variant of this lemma, to conclude, and I guess I rubbed it out, to conclude that either you look like a subspace, very, very much like a subspace, or you have a large negative Fourier coefficient. I just want to say that there is a version of this without this density hypothesis. You note the density hypothesis completely essential, because this had to be omega of 1, so that I could choose r not hammering off to infinity in some absurd fashion. Otherwise, this bound would have been very poor. You can do the normal thing of quotienting out Fourier space by the large spectrum to get some sort of, which is effectively this modeling approach of Green and Ruger, to get some kind of bound. You have to take a different approach if you want slightly better kind of density dependence. But I'll stop there.